If you're a seasoned improviser and you're looking for a new approach and maybe even a little inspiration to your scenic improv, then I'd like to help. If you're in Chicago this July and or August, I'll be offering my Artist Low Comedy Weekend Summer Intensive. If you're already coming into Chicago, why not take the opportunity to study with me and improvisers from all over the world, learning my unique slow comedy approach to improv that makes it as easy as having a conversation. The Artist Low Comedy Weekend Summer Intensives will be taking place on the weekends of July 14th and 15th, July 28th and 29th, and August 11th through 12th. To register or for more information, go to my website at jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com.
Hi, this is Dan Bacadall, and you're listening to Improv Nerd.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy.
Hey, everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you are listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Dan Bacadall. You know him from HBO's Veep and CBS's Life in Pieces. He's also an alumni of the Second City Main Stage, and he did lots of shows at the I.O. Chicago back in the late 1990s and early 2000s, including Zump with Miles Stroth. Dan recently returned to Chicago to do Trainwreck, his fully improvised show, with Eddie Furman at the Second City. Dan is not only a good friend of mine, he is also a great guest. He is so thoughtful about improv, he's open and honest about his life, and he's funny. We talked to Dan about why he is so happy with the state of improv in TV and film, what he learned about specifics in a scene when he first started out at the Players Workshop of the Second City taking classes, and why he doesn't play stereotypical characters today, and how he looks at that as a challenge to become a better improviser. Before we get to the interview with Dan, the reason you listen to this podcast is you like to get an update about my daughter, Betsy. And it's been such a long time since I released the last episode. You probably think she's in college now. She is not. She's in July. She'll be two. She won't be almost. She's almost two now. She'll be two in July. And she's starting to say words. Now, we had to bring in a speech therapist because the pediatrician didn't think that her words were developing fast enough, which surprises me because I'm a talker. My wife, Lauren, is a talker. We talk all the time. We'd rather talk than watch Netflix. We'd rather talk than play board games. So it's really the entertainment center of our lives. That is conversation. So we brought her in it. The speech therapist, and Betsy is starting to say words, and she says go now, she says up, she says Coco, which is the name of our cat, but today she said something that really touched me. She does say dada, it's kind of hard to make out, but you know, anything with a d sound I will take is a dada. So I was leaving, and when I leave the house, if I'm going to teach or if I'm going out somewhere to the store, Lauren always says, don't go, we want you to stay, don't go, don't go. And when I was leaving today, Betsy looked up with her little brown eyes and said to me, don't go. It was so cute. And if anything she said so far, that's the one that's touched me the most. All right, you've got a Betsy update. And now here's why you're listening to this podcast for this kind of interview. Dan Bacadall gives it all in this interview. Here it is. Enjoy the Dan Bacadall episode.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Dan Bacadall, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Of course, Jimmy.
Did you like that? We had Sam Bowers, our director, like say action. So
yeah, I like that there was a countdown. So as he counted into saying action, I went, oh God, it's coming. It's happening. It's here.
I'm just surprised that I, you know, got it.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah.
You got it. Although we've now talked about it.
Yes, we have.
Which makes it weird.
Is it too inside baseball to start? Well, whatever.
I don't think so.
No, I don't either.
You could always start the podcast with the countdown, and then they'll know what we're talking about.
Okay, I'm going to write that down. But let's talk about you for just a second.
Okay. 1 second.
After graduating from Florida State University, you tour for a year with the Repertory Theater of America.
Correct.
Before coming to there's people walking by.
Yes.
We just have to get used to that.
No, we hired those. Those people are getting $80 a day to do background work.
Now it makes sense why Sam told me I shouldn't talk to them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because if you talk to them on camera, they now get $180 a day.
Okay. That's good. It's so good to know.
Yeah. They become, what do they call it?
They get upgraded.
Yeah. They get upgraded.
Okay. Plus, you don't ever want to talk to extras. Is that right?
I don't.
Yeah.
God, no.
So let's get back to, you graduate from Florida State University.
Yeah.
You're doing Repertory Theater of America before coming to Chicago back in 1995.
Right.
With a goal of getting hired by Saturday Night Live.
True. Yeah.
Okay. And the first place you study at is the now defunct Players Workshop at the Second City.
Are they done? They're closed?
They're gone.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And you're studying with a guy named David Murphy.
He's
your first improv teacher. And he teaches you the importance of specifics. Can you tell me a little about...
Wow. What I liked about David was that he would stress specifics. And so I took that to mean, oh, okay, great. I got, you know, we're doing a scene about a donut shop. And someone said, what do you recommend? And I said, anything from here to here. You know, these are all great, but this one's got a pubic hair on it, so you don't want that. Like, this is a bad donut shop that knows there's a pubic hair on that donut and doesn't take it off and then tells a customer. And I thought, specifics, right? And everyone else was kind of sicked out by it and even kind of made fun of me after class. But David was kind of like, that's specifics. It tells us a lot about this donut shop. You know a lot about this place based on that one thing. And I thought, okay. In a way, he encouraged bad behavior, which I appreciated.
How were you when you first started out? You came from an acting background.
Yeah. I don't know, Jimmy. I thought I was good. You know, I hope that I'm not wrong about that. I felt comfortable. I felt like I was doing something that I was meant to be doing. It didn't feel... I don't know. You know, I just thought... This is just the same as acting, except you've taken away the hardest part, which is memorizing a line. I just do the same thing. What's the scene? I'll just do that.
And you told me a great story about working with Del. You only got to work with him a couple times, but the first time, can you tell me the first time you got to work with Del Close?
Yeah, I wish I knew what summer that was. I suppose it would have been 98, the summer of 98. I was in level one with Sharna. And it was super hot. It was one of these, it got so hot, there was a blackout type of thing. And then the power came back on. But IO's, you know, the now defunct space at 3541 Clark, right?
Right, right by Wrigley Field
right
there.
That space, the air conditioning went out or something. That's what it was. So there was a class upstairs in the Del Close Theater. Del had a class downstairs in the cabaret, the downstairs. And... So we were the level one class upstairs, but somebody else was in some pit somewhere back in the, you know, in the bowels of what would later become Goose Island or Mullins or something.
Some bar.
Yeah, and because their electric was out or their air was out, they had to come over and have the Del Close spot, and she put us in the green room of the Del Close Theater, which was horrible.
It was a small space
with yeah.
no windows, as I remember.
Right, yeah. The only window... There was a huge vent fan in there. It used to be a kitchen, so there was a huge vent fan in there.
People got high, did they turn that vent fan
Yes, they turned
on?
The okay, fan good. On, okay. And then blew it. And then, so if you're standing behind the building, you would smell the weed coming out of the green room. It was the 90s.
Because I never remembered, like, when I did Armando, people, after the show, they'd all go back there, and it was like an opium den.
Yeah, the door wouldn't close all the way because the fan was on. Right. So if you were trying to open the door, you'd go against the vacuum, and then all the... And then the air would really go up the thing. But they stood right under it. That's what it's invented for. Right. It's supposed to catch all the, you know, the good smells from the food.
It was big enough. I mean, so you could get six people at least.
Oh, God, at least.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we wound up having class in there 1 week, and I think she could tell that we were going to mutiny. Like, you're fucking us over. We paid you a lot of money. And our class is in a room that's not much bigger than this as far as space to play in. Two things happened. One, in that class, in the green room, she said, you know, a lot of people come here thinking they're going to become part of Saturday Night Live. You know, look around the room. Look to your left. Look to your right. None of you are going to be on Saturday Night Live.
How did you take that? Here's your goal.
I thought, fuck you. I'm going to put your head on my spike when I buy my SNL palace. You know, you're going to be the head that I mount on my wall. Like, I already didn't like her just based on I felt like she didn't know what she was... I hadn't taken a lot. I had taken Players Workshop and I had taken Second City classes, but I had taken enough to go, you don't do this work, do you? You've never done this. You've never gotten on stage. Anyway.
But fairness to you, you're also at the height of your drinking and doing drugs, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So you have I think the height came about 10 years later. Right. Well, about 8 years later. But
I mean,
still.
You're not like, you're at a different.
I'm not a level-headed, reasonable person necessarily. I'm mad at anything. Just give me a reason. So I think that she sniffed it out and was like, okay, I can't keep them in that closet anymore. We're going to have to bring them downstairs. Mm-hmm. So she said, guess what? We got something really exciting. You guys are going to have class with Dell this week. And we were all like, how's that exciting? This guy's scary as fuck. And now we're going to go downstairs to his class with all of his students who, I don't know what it's like now in the community, but back then there was definitely a hierarchy. It felt like seniors and freshmen, and we were freshmen and they were seniors. And then there's the grad students that are walking around doing Herald shows and stuff.
What scared you about him? Because you hadn't worked with him.
Well, everybody's stories were, he's scary as fuck. You'd see him and you'd be like, hi, Dale. And he'd go, who are you? And you go, oh, Jesus. You know, you're just terrified for very good reason. Anyway, so we had our class down there, and he said, I want to see what these new kids can do. Let's get you up on the stage. Let me give you a suggestion. I don't want to see the suggestion all over the place. You don't have to say it. Just use it, right? And he gave us the suggestion of Leather Jacket, and I stepped out on stage, and I kind of did like a, I was just thinking the Fonz, basically. Like, I'm wearing a leather jacket. I'm the guy that goes, hey, girls, how you doing? You know, that's it. And, all right, freeze. That was great. You, male pattern baldness, what's your name?
He called you male pattern baldness?
Yes. And I said, Dan. And he said, yes, great. He used the suggestion. He didn't have to beat us over the head with it. He didn't have to tell us what the suggestion was and say, I'm wearing a leather jacket. He just wore a leather jacket. And I thought, holy shit, that's it, man. That's what this is about. Like, getting the teachers, especially one who helped create this work, to recognize what you're doing tells me you're in the right place. You're going in the right direction. So the next week we go to class, and we're back in our regular classroom with Sharna, and she goes, wow, turns out Dell was very impressed with you guys as a class. He said that one student in particular, who he called male pattern baldness, he said reminds him of Bill Murray. He said, the next Bill Murray. And I was like, holy shit, this is amazing. So that Monday, I was took tickets. Yeah, yeah, the intern that took tickets
for Armando.
Armando. And Dell was sitting at the end of the bar like he always did for Armando, like right next to the office there. And I walked up and I said, excuse me, Dell. And he was talking to somebody. It's fucking. And I said, I heard you've been telling people I was bald. And he looked at me and he went, well, it appears I was right. And I went, yeah, all right. And just walked away. I never said another fucking word to him.
And what were you looking for him to give you?
I don't know. I was hoping he was going to go, yeah, this is the kiddos. To everybody gather around. The Savior is here. You know, I mean, I wanted to be, fuck, man. I wanted to be it. I wanted to be the guy that they say, we've been waiting. Here's the new breed. Here's the new batch. This is what it's going to look like. You know, I didn't know anything. I've been taking classes for, I think that was our fourth or fifth week. That it's fucking crazy talk in my head, Jimmy, to think that way.
You know, it's funny because I can relate to this because when I studied with Dell and all these other teachers, you always wanted to please them.
Sure.
But there's a point where it does get in the way, and it's always gotten my way. How have you been able to get over, like, I don't have to please that person. You know, you're doing Veep, or you're doing Life in Pieces, or you're doing a movie with Seth Rogen. It's like, I don't need these people's approval. How did you get to that point?
Well, I think you named three great examples, because you named two examples where I don't try to get approval, and you named one example where I did try to get approval, and it didn't go well.
Which one was that?
Which, with Observe and Report, I was like, all right, you got to make Seth Rogen happy. You got to do good stuff and make him, he needs to be happy with your work. And it didn't work. You know, I could tell he was just kind of like, this fucking guy. He was polite, and he wasn't wrong. I was no good. And, you know, it's not that I was bad. I was just brown paper bag, is my favorite expression. And, but when it comes to Veep, it comes to Life in Pieces, you know, dealing with award-winning actresses and actors and, you know, people you really respect, I just took the approach of, well, you got to go in there and light this fucking thing on fire and then make them beg you to put it out. Like, that's the thing that you got to do. You can't wait. You got to, it's better to ask for forgiveness, than beg for forgiveness, than ask for permission, right? And that's what I was doing, was just like, all right, then I'm just going to go in there and kick this shit in the nuts and see what happens.
When you do Veep and the character Roger Furlong, it's how do you approach it? Because he's so obnoxious.
Well, I just, the way it's written gives you the opportunity to do and say whatever you want. So I just take it as an opportunity to be that version of myself that everybody wishes they had an opportunity to do in public. You know, when you're in a car and you're going, you fucking piece of shit. If I fucking pull you out of your car, I'd kick you. I swear to God, I'd fucking rip your dick off. I'd feed you glass shards and watch you shit blood. Like, when you're screaming at this person and they can't hear you and you're going, oh, this is so cathartic. Well, in this case, everyone gets to hear it. It's even more cathartic. Yeah, and I'm getting paid to do it. And it's what they're asking for.
Well, you really seem to enjoy it. I don't know if that was automatic. Or you had to, if you started to ease into it, the more you did it.
No, I had to ease into it because I definitely felt like, oh my God, Elaine Bennis is going to be pissed at me for talking
Who's
to
Elaine
her.
Bennis?
Well, Julia's character from Seinfeld, you know.
Right.
I'm like, oh God, this woman that I've worshipped and my wife and I watched every week, every night on syndication on TBS, you know, she's going to be pissed at me for going too serious. I better tell her that I'm kidding. You know, like she doesn't know the difference, but that was my limited experience at the time. Was I'd never really played that type of character, so I didn't know what it was like to come in and insult somebody well, and then afterwards go grab a cup of coffee with them. It felt odd, but it took a couple seasons before I was like, oh, she's totally fine with what I'm doing, or else I wouldn't be here. She would have said, that guy, I don't like him. Don't bring him back. Give somebody else that role.
You've also said that she's very generous on set.
Yeah.
So for people that want to, you know, who are listening to this podcast, like, oh, when I get my own show, I'd like to be as generous as Julia Louis-Dreyfus. What can you give me an example of her generosity on the set with actors?
It's funny. I was just Ryan Haywood and I just went to the Steppenwolf show last night, and Rainn Wilson was the star of the show, right? I did an episode of The Office 10, 11 years ago now, and Rain and I sat like this all day long. And the guy spent the whole day going, you got your ears pierced? Yeah. Did you do it yourself? Yeah, I did in college. Yeah, you rock and roll, you play? No, I don't play anything. You got to play something. He just treated me like an old friend, and I thought, man, if I ever get a show, that's how I'm going to treat guest stars, co-stars, and the like. I was joking about extras. I'll talk to extras. I talk to stand-ins. I talk to anybody, because to me, for all I know, that guy winds up being the next Jerry Seinfeld. And that's not, and then he'll hire me. You know, I'm not thinking if I treat him well, he'll give me a job. It's he'll be in charge someday, and he'll treat his people properly because people treated him properly. That's what I was taught on that day. And the same thing with Julia. I came in to work with Julia and was, you know, afraid, was going to ask permission, and something in her demeanor said, don't ask me for permission, just go, right? And so I just went for it, and I improvised a line that she went, you know, after we were done, she said, I love that, that was really good, keep that. And that to me was everything, because right then she said, I trust your decisions, you're safe here, do what you want to do. We'll let you know when we don't like it. Because later they did. You know, there was one where I went all out, you know, neck veins bulging, spit flying. And she was like, oh, I think this is too intense. And I felt like a shamed puppy. I mean, it's just my nature that I went, oh, see, you blew it. Yeah, now you're fired. You know, it's all or nothing.
Yeah, I can relate.
Right? Yeah, I know.
Love the shame.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially when things are going good.
Don't yeah, so the better they're going, the more shame I can find. And that was the thing, was that she did that. She said, I think that's too big. And I didn't fight or argue for my stance on it. I saw the director fight for it and go, oh, I don't know. I think that's... And she went, no, it makes me uncomfortable. I don't... And he went, okay, Dan, we're going to pull that back a little bit. And I said, okay. I pulled it back and I saw the trust in her eyes of like, oh, you didn't fight. You didn't argue. You didn't push. You just went with the flow. And now, all these seasons later, I'm as vicious now as I wanted to be that day. It just took time for it to grow there.
How do you get over the shame in that moment? You're on a set. You've been given a direction. Well, you think in your head, like, I did the right thing.
Well, they slam the sticks and they start speeding again and it's over. It's time to move on because you're doing another take. So you can't be doing the last take in the middle of this take or else you're fucked.
You don't say, oh, give me a couple minutes. I'm going to go.
No, God, no. Okay. No, not okay. even as a regular on a show. I'm trying to think. I think one time on Legit with Jim Jeffries.
I love that show. I love that show. I think that was one of the best things you did.
Do you feel
the same way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I love Dark.
I think if there was anywhere to watch it, because it used to be on Netflix, it's not there anymore. Mm-hmm. If there was anywhere to watch it, I would still be telling people, go watch it. But the only way you can get it now is you got to buy it.
Is it the thing you're one of the things you're most proud
of? Oh, I think it's the thing I'm most proud of.
What is it that makes you so proud of that?
That it was dark and that it was hilarious. That there were some really heavy, real moments followed by really great laughs, which is kind of what I was taught when I started doing improv, was play it real and expect. I mean, Del's whole thing was play to the top of your intelligence and expect the audience to rise up to meet you. And that's what we were doing. We were playing, you know, masturbatory, drunk, cokeheads getting hookers with a little brother in a wheelchair. But we were playing it as real as we could, as honest as we could, so that when the jokes came, they had even more punch.
And didn't that something early on Martin DeMott instill in you?
Yeah, Marty DeMott in level one, you know, IFA, Improv for Actors at Second City, that was when I heard that, was he said, I'm not worried about funny, I'm worried about believability. I want to believe you first. Recognizable human behavior.
And what clicked for you then? When you heard that?
Well, I just thought, well, I'm a human. I can do that. I'm already an actor. I'm already doing that all the time in a play, except I have to remember this other guy's words, and that's not necessarily the way I would say it. Now I get to say it however I want, you know? But so what happened one day on Legit, something happened that I got pissed off, and I said, I need a minute! And I, you know.
Like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I walked out of the room, and I was going to call a bunch of people and go, these fuckers, I'm out of here, this fucking place. You know, and you take 2 or 3 minutes and you calm down a little bit and then you go, there's an awful lot of people sitting in there waiting right now. And not all of them are going, hey, he needs a minute. Some of them are going, who the fuck does he think he is? And the longer you're gone, the more that grows in them. And I don't need that and I don't want that. So I went back in and I said, sorry, I'm okay, let's go.
And how did you develop that? Because when I think about Second City, when you were on the main stage, it was like, okay, they're not doing it the way I want to do it, so I'm going to quit. It was kind of a reaction to stuff. How were you able, because I think a lot of people go, I mean, I know I've struggled with that. Like, they're not doing it my way, they don't see it my way, they're not listening to me, I'm going to quit.
Well, I think that was a progression to get from natural behavior, normal, regular human behavior of like, oh, something's happening I don't like, let me process this. You know, which is the way I started, even until when I first got here to Chicago, I was working at an office job, and every now and then I would go, oh, right, I need 5 minutes. And I would go downstairs and have a cigarette and just check out for 5 minutes, and then I'd come back and I'd be over it and everything would be okay. And it was only once I really started working at the Second City regularly, I think by the time I was on the main stage, that I started going, that part of me was gone. I think there was a real self-aggrandizing, self-righteous thing that came out that was like, you don't know how fucking lucky you are to have me here, you know? And if I'm not happy, then nobody's going to be happy. And that's the way this is going to go. And I found out pretty quickly that they went, we don't give a shit. Like, that's not important to us. There were people, Allison Riley reached out and said, what's going on? You're like unhappy all the time. What can we do to help you? And I went, oh, right. She said, I'm asking you personally, what can we do to help you? And I said, oh, okay, I suppose I could use some help. You know, but I looked at it like, well, there's this big corporation and it doesn't care about me. That's true. I think that's still true today. The business doesn't care how many bones it has to crush. It has to keep going or else it dies. Right?
You look back and say, oh my God, there was people when I was, because if you were the guy that was always not happy, you're going to make other people unhappy, right? Were there people that later you're like, oh, that you felt that you affected them or you made their situation at Second City not a pleasurable one?
Absolutely, but I think, to the best of my memory, I've gone back and spoken to all of them and said, hey, I'm sorry, that was inappropriate. And
How did people take it?
Most people went, what are you talking about? You were awesome. Most of them. Mm-hmm. And the couple that said, yeah, well, it was part of your charm. Or, yeah, well, I've gotten over it. Or, are you done? And in all cases, I just said, yeah, that's it. If you decide that there's something I can do that can fix that for you, make it right, you let me know and I'll be happy to do that. Take care.
Also, when you're at Second City, your goal of being on Saturday Night Live, when you get mainstage, you're in reach of it. You're close to it.
Yeah, they came and saw the show.
So tell me the time when they come knocking at the door, the first time they come knocking at the door when you're on the mainstage.
God. Well, everybody knew they were coming. And we knew they were coming to our show. They came to the show, and then after the show, they wanted to go out for drinks with us or something. And so we all went to, what was the place? It was the Hobos or something like that?
Hobos was down the street. It was down
on
the
Wells.
Basement.
Yep, that was it. Yeah. And they had karaoke there. Mm. And we all went there to do karaoke. And I remember Liz Kukowski, who went on to be a writer at SNL, but then went on to be a really great producer and writer in her own right on Last Man on Earth and lots of great projects. Anyway, she sang 9 to 5, Dolly Parton, and you could see when she was singing it, you went, she's going to get this fucking job. That's the perfect choice. Like, my mind was, being at the bar is still part of the audition. Getting up there and singing something karaoke is still part of the audition. And I don't know if she saw it that way, but when I watched her do that, I thought, this song is just funny enough and just tongue-in-cheek enough and just, who gives a shit enough.
And mainstream enough, too.
And mainstream enough that they would go, she's dynamite. And they were right. I'm
so
very
glad.
So
who's there with you? Like Marcy Klein and Mike Schumacher? No.
Yeah, those guys. Okay. The one that's, I was not a nice person. They're also not nice people.
Okay.
These two guys. I don't remember their fucking
names.
But
two guys, okay.
Ugh. Okay. Anyway, and so here's why I wasn't a nice person. I got up and sang, I don't know, Born to Run or something. You know, like,
you're
I'm
drinking.
Super fucking serious rock and roll guy.
Right.
You know, but hire me for your fucking sketch comedy show. God damn it. I've earned it and I'm funny. Fuck. You know.
And you're drinking, right?
Smoking weed in the bathroom and drinking at the table.
Great.
And then I go, hey, and they said to me, hey, do you know Rich Tallarico? And I said, yeah, I know. God, I love Rich. He's a god. I mean, for guys who came up in my generation, Rich Tallarico was a god. He wrote a ton of great stuff at Second City. And when he improvised, he was amazing.
And he was like a boy genius. He was like in his early 20s.
Exactly.
And you're like at this probably in your 30s, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And they said, what do you think of him? And I said, I think he's brilliant. And they said, you don't think he's an asshole? And I said, oh, man. You know, I don't know who said that to you that gave you that impression, but you got to take it all with a grain of salt. You know, maybe he was an asshole to whomever, because maybe they don't know what the fuck they're doing, you know? Because my assumption was the producers at Second City probably said he's more trouble than he's worth, because that was the quote. And I was like, you got to consider the source. You know, they don't know talent. They're, anyway. And they said, oh, so are you an asshole? And I said, sure. I mean, everyone's an asshole at some level or another. Let me ask you a question. And they were like, yeah. And I said, are you actually here to hire anybody or are you just here to make everyone nervous? And they went, oh, yeah, no, we're actually hiring. And I said, okay, great. And then they turned around and never made eye contact with me again the whole time they were there. And the next night we got a fruit basket with a cheese plate and everything from them. And they came to the show again. And they did not speak to me. And I thought, oh, fuck, you stepped in it. You really... I'm not saying... I don't think I did anything in that show to make me worth having on SNL. I don't think I was ever going to get that job based on what I did at Second City. I just didn't work hard enough, try hard enough. And I was probably too old. But that was my limited experience.
Well, you did prove to them... You told them the truth that you were an asshole at that point, and you backed it up.
Yeah, I backed it up by then doing something very asshole-ish.
We got to take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back after this.
Now, when you saw that kind of slip away from you, Were you mad at yourself, or did you, or were you like, I don't care, I didn't really want it anyway?
Oh, yeah, the grapes were probably sour anyway, but I also knew, like, oh, you fucking blew it your whole life. Jimmy, since my parents got a video camera, one of those big ones that was the size of a guitar case, you mm-hmm. know, I was doing sketch comedy at home. My family did SNL in our house in 1978.
So you're talking back to the original.
When I was an 8-year-old, yeah.
Dan Aykroyd,
when I was an 8-year-old, I did Samurai Delicatessen in a gown with a kimono with a hat and a big machete, and my brother's friend came in and ordered the sandwich, and we just basically did all the bits that they did. And I knew that's what I wanted to do. And then I did a sketch comedy show of my own, which was kind of like a Ronan Martin's Laugh-In. I stole a bunch of their jokes and just did them as a 8-year-old, 9-year-old. And one of them, I couldn't find my suit pants, and I was doing the newscast. Hello, and welcome to the news. I'm Danny Backadall. And, you know, it's been widely reported that newscasters are reporting the news in their underwear. Oh, boy. More on that after this break. And then I stood up and walked away from the desk, and you could see I was in my underwear. It's good joke construction. I built that one myself at 8. And so I thought, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I've trained my whole life for. And I just basically, I knew I threw it away. But there's a comfort in that control when I was in that kind of headspace. When I was as fucked up as I was at that time, being in charge of why I didn't get SNL was all the comfort I needed. I was sure I wasn't going to get it, and them rejecting me would not be enough. That would hurt too much. So me saying, you guys are just here to fuck with us, is me taking control and saying, I'm not going to get this job, and here's why.
Well, you bring up a really good point, and it's something that I struggle with, and I imagine I would like to know your take on this. People think, okay, you get Life in Pieces, or you get Veep, and it's really exciting and whatever. But that's really like taking in that kind of success is scary, and you can't control that. And in a lot of times when good things happen to me, my wife gives me shit for this, but I'll go, I'll be like, oh, something great happened. I want to die. I can't take this in. What is it like? Is that similar sometimes when you get something that's great? It's like, oh, I don't, or the I don't deserve this, or I'm a fraud, or I'm going to
fire. Sure, absolutely. And the good news is everybody has it. And anybody who sits with you and tells you that they don't is a fucking liar. Because I've spoken to Academy Award winners, Grammy winners, Oscar winner, Emmys, it doesn't matter. The name of the award doesn't matter. I've spoken to people across all lines of work, and they all have it. The ones that are willing to be honest about it have said, oh my God, darling, are you kidding me? No matter how many years I've been doing this, I'm still terrified constantly that today's the day.
Today's the day they'll be fired.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or they'll find out.
Or that everyone will find out that this was a sham mm-hmm. and all they are is a hairdo or whatever, you know, whatever their thing is.
When you wake up and you have that, I
don't wake up with it anymore.
Oh, good. Good.
That much. I don't know. I think when I had kids and I started focusing on these kids don't give a shit what I do for a living. They just want to have those cool socks mm-hmm. or those shoes with heels on them or wheels on them or whatever. They don't give a shit about all that stuff. They want me there, and they want these things. I try to teach them the things don't matter as much, but good luck, you know. And being present made all the difference in the world. And then I went, I'm a fucking better dad than my dad was. Not for lack of trying. He tried, but he did the best he could with what he was given. And I'm the difference between a fucking lion that would eat its cubs and a human being from his father. You know, I mean, his father was the lion that would eat the cubs, you know. And so I go, that's how much, I'm good. We've made as much progress as we need to make in this family for my generation. Now, you know what I mean? Like, I've done so much better than they did that everything else is gratis.
Well, so how do you keep going then? Like your Life in Pieces, I'm sure is going to, you know, knock on wood, is going to go for a while.
Yeah, who knows?
You're in every major movie that comes out.
Every fucking... I don't know if you saw Black Panther. That was me.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, I'll go to the movies, and I'll be like... I'll see a trailer, and you're in it,
yeah.
You know? And what is next for you?
I hope writing and developing is next, but I'm not going to... When I moved to Chicago, well, before I even left Florida State, my goal was I want to be on Cheers and I want to be on The Simpsons. Those were the two, that tells you when I graduated from college. Right. Those were the two biggest things on television at the time in comedy. And I think I'm doing Cheers. I'm not doing a show that is as impactful. It's not as funny. It's not as great as Cheers was, but it is the same vehicle. It is a primetime national network comedy on which I got to play a great character that grows over the course of years and scenes. You know, mission accomplished. And then I wanted to do The Simpsons, and I just got to do Tarantula with my friend Carson for TBS. And I went, that's it. I did an animated primetime half-hour show where I'm a major part of it. I did several voices per episode. Mission accomplished. So I'd like to continue to do that, and I would like to set a new goal. And my new goal is, you know, part of it is family stuff, but the other part is develop. I'm writing. I've never really written before. I didn't write in Level 5 at Second City. I didn't write in the main stage show.
Yes.
You know, and so I'm
finally
writing.
You didn't
think
you were a writer back then.
Well, I think it's the same as, are you going to hire anybody? You're just here to make us nervous. Mm-hmm. It was, well, but if I sabotage this, then I'm in charge of how this fails, rather than it fails and I'm hurt. If I'm in charge of how it fails, then I don't have to be hurt. That's the thinking. And if you think that way, anybody who's listening or watching, get help, because it's not true. It doesn't fucking work. Cookies help, but they don't fix it.
And so what, because you told me that you've written three screenplays?
No, two. One full screenplay, I'm halfway through another, and I've written two pilots.
All right.
In the last year.
So all of a sudden, what changed to have this confidence? You quit Second City. You quit Players Workshop because you couldn't write.
Yeah.
You showed up at the main stage just with ideas.
Even The Daily Show, I showed up at The Daily Show and it was encouraged to write. And I went, oh, fuck.
It's almost like a guy
Here's that thing again.
It's almost like a guy who can't read, who thinks he's like, and he's trying to cover.
Or like a billionaire businessman who thinks he's great at business but is just slowly sliding backwards and eventually gets promoted to president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And then finds out, my God, I should have learned how to do anything and I'd be prepared for something. Mm-hmm. But instead I'm in a position where I don't know how to do fucking anything, so I'll just keep firing at everyone and everything. I'm talking about myself now.
Okay, great. Because I was thinking, if not, that would be a really good pitch for
real life scenario for End of the World. I think so too.
Don't you think? I don't know if it would be believable.
That's it's not believable. Thing. Trust me. Every day I do wake up with that. This isn't believable.
No. But how did you get to the point where, okay, I am a writer?
It was that. It was just, okay, I'm a writer. Okay. But what it really was a specific person, Jude Wang, who's a director on Life in Pieces. She also did a bunch of Fresh Off the Boat and Crashing and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. She's directed a ton of really great television and film. And she said to me, how come you don't write? And I said, well, I don't know how to write. And she said, that's going to change tonight. And I just thought, well, that's weird. You don't know me. And you just said, I'm going to write tonight. And she goes, here's why. Do you have a story? And I said, yeah. She said, just one story in particular that you love, that you think needs to be told. And I said, well, yeah, I got a bunch. She said, just the one. Go home and write it tonight, like short form story, like a short story. And I said, well, fuck, I can do that. And that was it. After that, she sent me an email saying, great, now write it into an outline. And I said, yeah, I can do that. And she said, now get index cards and write out the beats of the story and put them on your wall. Get a cork board, hang it on your office wall, and put photographs up there of the story. Tell the story through photographs. Download photos online. And I was like, well, I can do all that. I can't write. And she was like, okay. Just keep going. And then at a certain point, almost exactly a year ago, she said, now write me five pages, five scenes, whatever you can do in the next week. Next Wednesday, I want five pages or five scenes, whatever you can do. And I went, well, fuck, I can do that. And I sat down and wrote five scenes, which is around 25 pages.
But what I hear in that is like, there was a part of you that couldn't do it without the help of somebody else, and you were open to taking that help.
Yeah, I mean, I am an actor. I take good direction. I'm good at taking direction. It's the reason why when I started taking improv, I needed the teachers like Martin DeMott and Mick Napier and Miles Stroth saved my life when it comes to performance, because he said, you're really good at this if you just stop trying to make people laugh. you're really good at this if you'd act like yourself instead of always having to hide in these characters, right? Little things that, like, the way he worded it might be a little too aggressive for some people, but for me, all I heard was the note of play yourself. Okay. Don't go for the joke. Okay. But listen, follow them. Okay.
You said to me that the gruff people, the Noah Gregoropoulos's, the McNapiers, the Miles's, the Dave Murphy's, they got to you.
Somehow, yeah. Well, I guess that's who my dad was. My stepdad was very, you know, I'm going to come over there and kick you in the ass if you don't follow directions. And it's like, well, then how did this driveway get raked and the lawns get, you know, get taken care of? How did all this stuff get taken care of if I don't take directions? You keep telling me and then I keep doing it.
You're back in Chicago now to do a show with Ed Furman.
Right.
And if you see the show, all right, for improvisers, they see the show, you guys will, in character, argue 20, 25 minutes. It's one long scene. And an improviser may come up to you and say, well, I've been taught arguing doesn't work. We're told we shouldn't argue in scenes. What would you tell them?
Well, I remember level whatever it was. I don't know what level it was. I was in I.O., but I was on my first Herald team that I.O. put together. I had a cage match team that we put together. But the first team that, you know, I.O. put together, John, I can't remember his name, Mulaney. Mulaney. No, not Mulaney.
Kevin Mulaney.
No, John.
Tall guy, John.
Yeah. Irish
last name.
Yes.
John.
Exactly.
He'll come to me.
Mahoney. Anyway, okay. John Mahoney was our coach. And he.
Sorry he passed away.
Yes, it's okay. He's still alive. It's weird.
Yeah.
But
Mulaney, John Mulaney.
No. Anyway. Okay. Let's see, we got to move on.
Yeah, we do.
He said to me one time, he said, you know, you're supposed to play at the top of your intelligence. And we were all like, yes, sir, yes, sir. And he said, but you can play stupid. And I said, what? And he said, because you play stupid smart. That's the way it's supposed to be done. You have to play, if you're going to be stupid, you have to be smart. The player has to be smart about playing stupid. The same way that you have to find a way to agree in your disagreement. It's the movie Sling Blade, right? Is the dumbest fucking character in the world. He is stupid as shit. But he is written so beautifully and so human that you fall in love with this person who's essentially a murderer. You know, in the end of the thing, he murders somebody. Spoiler alert on the 25-year-old movie. And you feel for him in that moment, right? Well, why? Because it's being done in a way that's intelligent. It's being done in the most intelligent way. So Eddie and I will get into an argument, for instance, over a razor. What happened to my razor? Well, I used it to shave my balls because I have a date tomorrow, right? Well, that's not a balls razor, that's a face razor. I know, actually, there's no difference. Hair is hair. No, that's not true, because pubic hair is more rigid, and it's got a thicker gauge than your typical head hair. Now, we're getting into details that, whether they're true or not, are at least examining a deeper thing here, not just, you shaved your balls with my razor.
Why did you tell me the story? You find it so funny?
Well, because it's what really, it's Eddie. That's how Ed Furman is. He'll take something like this, like me going, where's my razor? And he goes, what does it look like? And you go, it's a fucking razor. What do you mean, what does it look like? Did you take my razor? I don't know. I used a razor. Do you have a razor? No. Then what do you think that means? You know, and we're arguing, but we're arguing in a way that, as two improvisers, you know that what he's saying is, keep asking me questions that make me look like, obviously I used your razor, but I'm not going to admit to using your razor. Do you have a razor? No. Then who else's razor could that have been? I don't know. We're the only two that live here. Right. So you used my razor. I guess through that logic, yes, I did use your razor. Fine. Why did you use my razor? I needed to shave my balls. Right? Now, at that point, of course, there's a huge, reaction. But then Ed gets into the smart part of it of, like, it doesn't matter, you know, all hair's the same, and I get into as much intelligence as I can in it by saying certain gauge and so forth, right? So as long as you're moving forward in some way, what's the difference? Whether you're moving forward through, let's go to the beach, yes, let's, and let's play volleyball, yes, let's, and let's cook hot dogs, okay, what else is at the fucking beach, who cares? Like, you guys, we don't know anything about you. Eddie and I will be telling things about ourselves by our opinions. So moving it forward, or me laying an opinion on him, tells you more about Eddie, and I gave it to him.
And also, isn't there a part of you that, like, naturally there's an instinct like, okay, we fought about this too much. We completed this beat. Let's move on to something else.
And that's the beauty of a show that's played in real time, like Trainwreck, where you just go for 45 minutes and don't stop and no editing, is that at some point, you know, look, if we weren't sitting here with a microphone and cameras, at some point you and I would stop talking, and then one of us would go, hey, have you seen any movies lately? And start a new conversation. And what'll happen naturally in Trainwreck is eventually we'll be like, all right, shut up. Fuck. And one of us will leave the stage. I mean, where are you going? None of your business. And the other one will be forced to do something out there, you know, make a bed, smoke a cigarette, make pancakes, while the other one goes to the bathroom, packs a suitcase, you know, calls their mom, whatever it is that's happening off stage. And then they come back out and a new thing starts up. Ideally, what happens is, and this was Miles's thing too, was, you know, you start in first gear and you don't always have to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but you go 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 12, you know, 120, 1, 3, 5, 120, 1. You know, you got to shift those gears. So that's what we try to do as much
Meaning
as we
can. Meaning you like crescendo to something.
The intensity, yeah.
Just like in a long form piece.
Yeah, and then let it.
Yeah, if you have a crazy scene with a lot of energy and a lot of people, you want to,
right.
The next scene, you want to bring in a slower energy.
Right.
And you're doing the same thing, but you're doing it with two people.
Right.
Ed and you approach is different. You're more of an IO school. He's
right.
More of annoyance school.
Right.
But you guys have been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
So what have you learned from Ed that?
Well, once it goes back to the David Murphy thing, it's specifics. I learned from Eddie that, like, simply picking up a magazine and going, you subscribe to Elle magazine, tells us a shitload about you. Like, his gifts are so specific, even though there's a judgment from his character to the thing that he's declaring for you, he is making it so specific that we get to know who you are. He uses such deep specifics, and he'll also say things that afterwards I go, is that true? And he goes, fuck, I don't know. You know, we 2 years ago, I think, when we did this, he started talking about dimensions. And I said, well, there's actually 10 dimensions. I had looked this up for some reason. And I knew there were 10 dimensions. And I only know that a point is 1, a line is 2, a plane is 3, a cube is 4. And after that, I don't know, right? And I said that, and he went, there's 3 dimensions. 1, that's it. And then afterwards I went, is that true? And he goes, fuck, I don't know. What were you talking about? And I said, I don't know. I read it on Wikipedia. I don't know what's true. But that's what's so great about improv is we get on stage and act like an expert and go on and on and on and on and not have to stop, pause, or apologize.
How do you do that, being an expert, and not feel like you're just inventing it versus making the discovery?
Well, it'd be one thing to be like, we come to a spot where we don't know what we're going to say next, and I go, there's a bomb! You know, like, that would be invention. Or, there's a mosquito on your head, or something like that. It just seems like it would come out of nowhere. But if we're in the middle of talking, and, you know, I'm flipping through Elle magazine, which he laid on me, right? And I go, yeah, I read it. You know why? 10 tips to orgasms. Not for guys, for girls, right? Tip number 1. You know, I'm going to do my best to create 10 and try to remember as many of them as I can, because I know that that's the kind of thing that's gold 40 minutes from now, when you remember those 10 things, or when Ed remembers those 10 things, or when he fills in 2 of them. You know, I say 1 and he goes, yeah, 2, cradle the balls, work the shaft. Everybody right. knows that one. Right, exactly. Number 3, you know what I mean? That's not invention. That's exploring, you know, deepening and heightening a thing is the most valuable tool we have. And I struggled mightily with invention. Miles was all over my shit all the time for invention. And I said, but how is that invention? He goes, because you're going outside of what already is. It's us driving in a car and me going, ooh, Burger King. And he goes, see, now what was wrong with the car? Why did we need Burger King? You're inventing something down the road instead of what's going on here between us. And I go, I don't know. I guess I don't understand the difference. But with time, I learned to understand the hot spots, like, well, don't touch that.
Right. And that, you know, it's there. It's always there for us.
You know?
You know, We've got to wrap this up, but I wanted to talk about this because the last time you did Improv Nerd was about 3 or 4 years ago, and we did a scene where we played two very exaggerated characters, a gay hairdresser.
Very flamboyant,
And I'm wondering now, today, if we were to do that again, how would we play those stereotypes?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Jimmy, because I even this morning I was listening to Al Jolson, and I thought, are you allowed to listen to Al Jolson anymore? Like, not like, the PC police going to come get you, but more like, do I want to give money to the people that are descendants of Al Jolson, the guy who used to walk around with blackface on? Do I want to perpetuate that all these years later? And the same goes for a scene like that. Like, if you and I were going to do that scene today, I definitely would not open with, did you change the barbicide, bitch? Like, it's just not. I want to say it's not as acceptable anymore, but it's not about whether or not it's acceptable. It's just not, it doesn't feel right anymore. Back then it felt like, well, I didn't know or care what anybody thought, but I've certainly felt a change in that
and
in the community.
You experienced it recently at Second City.
Second City in Hollywood.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I was doing a show, a Mr. Johnson show with Kevin Fleming and, Fleming! No.
Joe Canale.
And Joe Canale, yeah. And we did something where it was
John
Mulhern. That was it. We got it. All right, let's go.
Go on. Okay.
Anyway, Joe was buying drugs, and Kevin said, why don't you go back to your dealer and get something else? And then he went to me, and I went, look who's back. Rainy day. You only come around when you need something. And then I went to the fridge, and I went, you can't use that fucking voice. Because I could hear and feel in the audience like, ooh, that doesn't feel appropriate. And I thought, oh, shit, things have changed, you know. And I didn't go, they're taking away my favorite stereotypes. I just went, oh, I get it. You know, look, fuck, if it makes someone uncomfortable, I'm not interested in making someone uncomfortable. Although, you know, at the same time, I would talk about idiots who need guns instead of their dicks all day long. I don't mind hurting their feelings. But I... There was something that I was sensitive to in the air in that moment where I went, I see, that shit doesn't fly anymore. You know, bald, waspy guy doing, you know, super stereotype black drug dealer voice is not going to work. So when I turned back around, I said, and I tell you something, man, and I just turned him into a redneck, and instantly it was, ha, 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 everything was giggling and going well, and I went, well, that's interesting. It's the same fucking person. I just changed the skin color through changing the tone of the voice, right? And it's okay now. And I thought, all right, I guess, you know, we're three white guys on stage, so we're going to have to stay away from playing the certain types of characters. And you know what I noticed, Jimmy, is that I myself, without any outside encouragement, stopped playing the bitchy, whiny wife a while ago because I just went,
when you would play the opposite
the stereotype of being the wife who's like, I said get in here, dinner's ready. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what the fuck? You know, I have a daughter. What I'm implying in that moment is this is what wives are like. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what my daughter will be like when she grows up. Well, that's not what my wife was like. It's not what my mom was like. It's not what my sisters are like. So how about challenge yourself, again, back to Dell's thing of like play to the top of your intelligence. Now it's about playing to the top of your character intelligence, like from your nest of characters. Play from the smartest place you can. When I auditioned for, this is actually plays perfectly into this, when I auditioned for Modern Family, I auditioned for the role of Cam, mm-hmm. which is Eric Stone Street. And I read it, and he's gay. They're not, I don't know if they were married in the script, doesn't mm-hmm. matter. And I looked at it and I went, oh, okay. They can't possibly want to come in there and go, oh, it's just, I thought, no, this is a fucking network show. It's ABC, Fox is pretty, no. So I played it like this. You know, I came in and I went, well, what are we doing? Aren't we going to have dinner? And the casting director's, cut, honey, you don't know anything about being gay. And I was like, okay. Like, and I thought, no, that's not true. But okay. I just took the note and he gave me another sides to read. And then I saw the show and Eric is great, but Eric plays it very flamboyant, and those guys exist, mm-hmm. just the same as the other partner in that relationship also exists much more, you know, straight-laced, subdued character. But for some reason, it wasn't believable coming from me, or wasn't what they wanted for the character, or whatever. But I looked at it and I thought, yeah, that's where we're fucked, is there's certain things that we expect from a character. If you tell me drug dealer, we expect him to be, hey, man, or fucking toothless redneck, or really spooky, scary black guy, right? It's, well, anyway, that's what I think, right? Mm. And so now I'm going to try to force myself to change what I think of. Can't a drug dealer also be a guy that comes in a suit with a briefcase and goes, so what are you looking for? We got a little bit of everything.
Right, lives in the suburbs and...
Yeah, just, he's like, oh, the city's gross, man. I want to live in this. I live in Wheeling. I got a great place, tennis court, you know. It's really nice. You know, why not? Those guys exist too. And it also forces me to challenge myself to try to grow more. But I've noticed that the more time you take off, the more things change and the more behind you are. So I took a lot of time off, and then I came back and went, oh shit, things are changing, and they're changing quickly.
What do you still like about improvising?
It's the only place where I feel like I'm falling, you know, where I still feel like who knows what's going to happen. You know, if I'm allowed to improvise on a TV show on Life in Pieces or Veep or something, you know that the net is right here, mm-hmm. and you have the safety rope, and you know what I mean? Like, and it's a green screen, so you're not even actually falling. Like, all these tricks that they use that make it like you're not really improvising, because we're just going to throw it away if it doesn't work. On a stage in front of a live audience, and you go, oh, look who's here, Mr. Rainy Day, and then you go, oh, shit. I got to find a way to not just go, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry, that was insensitive, and I got to find a way to work my way out of this rather than just back out and bail.
And you're very happy with the state of improv in terms of TV and film.
Yeah, I think that we finally found a happy medium where it's not what it was 10 years ago when they were improvising on every set, not every set, but a lot of sets were improvising, and it was just throw as much shit against the wall as you can and see if something sticks, not caring if it fits with the story or not. Now it's much more about improv is coming in, and that area, that line right there, that one's a freebie. Just do whatever that fits that mold. You know, if the line, like on Life in Pieces, a lot of times I'll have things like, you know, oh, don't make her mad. When she gets mad, it's worse than fill in the blank. And they'll have a line written, and then they'll come up and say, we got these alternates. And I go, you mind if I try something? And they go, no. And then I'll just, on action, I'll say whatever comes to mind and see what I improvise. A lot of times it's super dark and not usable, but that's kind of fun because it makes the crew and the editors laugh.
We got to wrap this up. We end the podcast with, you know this, one piece of advice you would give an improviser starting out today.
Well, since I've done this before, Jimmy, I'll try to say something different this time.
Okay.
I would still say don't quit, because it's the only, you know, the only way to know what you're going to get is quit. And never give up and all that jazz. But if I were going to say one thing that I would want to say to improvise, I still think it's move to Chicago. I mean, I just...
Because you've also improvised in New York and L.A.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah. And I think that there is... And I don't know. I'll find out tonight. I'm going to go over to I.O. and play with some old friends. Maybe I'll find out that everything's fucked. But I doubt it. I just feel like the way the work was done here, the way the work was held in such reverence here... There's a different thing to it here. If you really want to commit to this work, if improv is important to you, and it's something that you want to use as a tool in your belt, or if it's the end of the line for you, like that's what you want to be doing, this is the place to do it. And you're going to learn and build the skills in a grad school environment, basically, because you can go to 3, 4, 5 different schools. Train, watch shows, do shows, watch shows, do shows, train, watch shows, do shows, rehearsals, coaching, teaching, all that kind of stuff. You can really, really immerse yourself in it here.
Dan Backetall, thank you so much for
being
our guest
Jimmy.
On Improv Nerd.
Thanks.
And there you have it, another great episode of Improv Nerd. And I don't think I oversold this episode. I think this episode was terrific. And Dan delivered, like I said, so thoughtful, so honest, so funny. And I love what he talked about how he's adapting, playing stereotypical characters, and how he looks at this as a challenge to become a better improviser. I'd like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you would not be hearing my voice right now. Also, to the director, Sam Bowers, and to Joe Pisanzio, who, along with Dan Schiffmacher, taped this episode, and you will get this episode will be released on Patreon probably in a couple months. So look for that. Also, if you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv workshops, classes, and intensives called The Art of Slow Comedy, go to my website at jimmycorain.com and sign up for my Improv Nerd blog. Each week, I send out a blog that will make you a better improviser and a better person. Well, the better person is up to you. Also, follow us on social media. Like us on Facebook, Improv Nerd. It really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter, Improv_Nerd. And check out our YouTube channel and subscribe. That's Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word. Also, go over to Patreon and sign up, subscribe, whatever they call it in Patreon. We have teaching lessons there, and we release full episodes of Improv Nerd. Of course, I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it. And here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right. Scarface, the new frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL. The 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome, not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve a pay in Spanish,
oh my God.
He spots his dear friend, who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh, my God.